This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Nasser with Anton LaGuardia, the diplomatic editor of The Economist magazine. And we're faced with what in Newtonian physics is known as the three-body problem. I follow Anton's reporting here. The two planets, you can predict their orbits around each other. But three planets, no, you can't predict it. And three planets are now Moscow, Beijing, and Washington. And with nuclear weapons in the arsenal of the U.S. and Russia, the news is that China is adding quickly to its nuclear arsenal so that it looks to have, according to the recent news, Reuters telling us, it looks to have 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2035. Let us try the Cold War doctrines, and do they apply? Anton, as I understand it, nuclear weapons then and now with the Biden administration are seen as a counter to other nuclear weapons. In other words, they're understood as counterforce. Does that work with three nuclear powers?
There's a whole host of doctrines to do with nuclear weapons and nuclear warfare. So just to take one step back, if I may, at one end you have minimum deterrence, which says what I need is to have a sufficiently large arsenal that if you attack me first, I have enough left with which to destroy your cities. That's all I need. America and the Soviet Union embarked on a thing called counterforce, which was, in essence, the belief that you could win, you could fight and win nuclear war by targeting each other's weapons to limit damage on yourself. That means that if the enemy has another 10 weapons, I need another 10 in order to knock them out. Therefore, you had this incredible buildup to about 60 or 70,000 warheads at the height of the Cold War. And American targeting doctrine still retains an element of counterforce. What they say they target is the things the enemy values most. And that's a kind of woolly, fuzzy concept, but it includes leadership, it includes military facilities, and it includes nuclear weapons. They say they don't deliberately target cities because that would be against the law. So in a strange way, in order to comply with the law, with the laws of war, they say we need a lot of nuclear weapons to target all these other things. Now, if there are more targets the U.S. has to worry about because China is growing fast and Russia has a large arsenal, the debate becomes, does the U.S. need to increase the size of its arsenal?
Another doctrine that worked in the first Cold War with Russia was called generally peaceful coexistence. In other words, we can nuke you, you can nuke us, therefore let's get along and find ways to talk together. Does that work with a three-body problem, Anton?
It would be nice if everybody could speak to each other because it helps build confidence and understanding what the other side is up to. The trouble is that the Americans and the Russians are not speaking because of the war in Ukraine, and the Americans and the Chinese are not speaking because the Chinese have an aversion to arms control because they see it as a means of whereby the Americans would try to restrain them. I think there's also a degree of suspicion about the intrusion that arms verification requires. And I think they're more secretive on these things than the Russians are. And I think it also has to do with a different historical experience. America and the then Soviet Union lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, which was a heart-stopping moment when it seemed like the world really might see nuclear war. They pulled back from the brink and they began talking and they began a process of gradually reducing the role of nuclear weapons. So the hope is that the Americans and the Chinese can begin to talk, particularly as the Chinese gain confidence. President Biden has talked to President Xi Jinping about things called guardrails, which is everything from, you know, how do we behave when we meet in the air or at sea, and also want to engage them in the among the P5 on risk reduction in the nuclear realm, and would dearly like to begin arms control talks with the Chinese. But there's just very little sign that that's leading anywhere.
When we come to the U.S., there are hawks and doves. The hawks, represented by very strong voices, say, don't wait, start the contest again, reorganize our nuclear force. Are there hawks in Moscow? Are there hawks in Beijing comparable to your understanding, Anton?
It's more difficult to read the debate in Beijing and in Russia because you don't have the culture of openness and ubiquitous coverage that you get here. I think for the Russians, who are economically stressed by the war in Ukraine, who want to use their nuclear power to try and level up the situation, have a short-term interest in trying to keep nuclear tensions up, but in the longer term, I think, would not want to get into a new arms race with the Americans, particularly now that the Americans have begun to modernize their arsenal. The Chinese is a different matter, and there's a debate as to how quickly they can really create the fissile material that you need to put inside nuclear weapons. They are doing it through a thing called fast breeder reactors, which to people who understand these things better than I do tell me is quite hard to do. So the assessment of the speed at which they can build up is dependent on the success with which they can get fast breeder reactors going. And in general, I think they want to build up to have a world-class military force, as they call it, by 2049, and they have various milestones in between. And hovering over all this is the question of Taiwan and whether the Chinese would want to take it by force and whether a regional conflict of that kind would lead to a military conflict between America and China, and whether that would carry the risk of nuclear escalation as well.
And now we come to the fact of those silos building in, I believe, Northwest China. They have been mysteriously presented as evidence that China is going on a hawk phase. Is that, to your understanding, do we have clarity? Are those silos to be filled? Are we looking at a head faint? What do they mean?
They're probably one of two things. One is they could all be filled. There's about 300 of them. In the same way as the U.S. has about 400 silo-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. And the reason for putting them in silos is that you can fire them off very quickly. And you also act as what you call a nuclear sponge. You draw the fire towards them. But it means that you're on a hair trigger posture. You're on a thing called launch on warning. Because they're vulnerable and visible, it means that you have to use them right away if you see a salvo of missiles coming your way. So it makes for a more unstable situation. The other possibility is that they're going to put some ICBMs in there, but play a shell game. Move them around the silos so you never quite know where they are. And that's also a possibility. It means they have to commit fewer weapons to them, and the U.S. still has to take them all out because it doesn't know which ones have real ICBMs and which ones don't. But that implies a change of doctrine and also change in size. The question among nuclear wonks, John, is whether China is going to move away from what you call the no first use doctrine, which is that they will not use nuclear weapons unless they are attacked first. That is still consistent with launch on warning, because on the warning, you are presumably being attacked with nuclear weapons. Therefore, you're entitled to use them. But the Chinese have made great play of the fact that they maintain a no first use policy, whereas the U.S. and the Russians don't. And it would be a big change for them to come off that posture. So we wait and see to see what happens.
Anton LaGuardia is the diplomatic editor of The Economist magazine. Welcome to the 21st Century Nuclear Standoff. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.